politics, and there's a heap of it about this week, that's for sure. So we welcome our commentators. Stephen Mills is in the Wellington studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Matthew Hooton is in the Auckland studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Matthew is an Auckland-based PR and consultant and lobbyist, and Stephen is a Wellington-based executive director of UMR Research and a former political advisor to two Labor governments. Look, there's a lot to get through, gentlemen. Let's just have a look at the local elections, particularly with any implications in mind for central government. Some of the big centres in particular, some interesting results. Wellington, I suppose, was the upset. Stephen and I were just debating how much of an upset that was. Phil Goff probably back pretty comfortably in Auckland. Just pick up with your take on results, Matthew.
Well, I don't think there are many implications for central government. If anything, things tend to go the opposite way than the way they went in local government over the years. I think the reason for that, for the reason I don't think there is any particular link, is that the turnouts are particularly for Mayor of Auckland, which is the one I've followed closest, is so poor that you just have a completely different voting base from whom is voting in local government and central government elections. So it seemed to be a good day for incumbents, except in Wellington, obviously. The main thing I take from it, though, again, this is an Aucklander speaking, is the profound democratic deficit up here. And it's similar, but in the other direction, to that terrible problem that the European Union identifies about itself, its democratic deficit that's causing all sorts of problems, as we know. And these council-controlled organisations are completely out of control. You know, the idea you elect somebody and anything's going to be different on the ground is not something that Aucklanders experience. And so I really think that I hope the mayor, the newly elected mayor, is successful. I hope he moves fast and quickly and boldly in reversing that council-controlled organisation model, because it's failed.
What can he do, though? Because that's legislated for, isn't it?
Well, he's the mayor. He's just been elected with a mandate of 30% of people voting, and he overwhelmingly won. And I think he has to say, look, the council-controlled organisation model is based on the state-owned enterprises model for central government. When state-owned enterprises were set up in the 1980s, it was to prepare them for sale. That's why they were kept independent. You don't have an intention to
sell
them. That
would have been used to the Labor Party at the time.
They began selling them. They were set up to bring what were government departments into a corporate model so that they could have been privatised. That was the purpose of them. There's no intention to leave something as a council-controlled organisation or a state-owned enterprise if your intention is to leave it in state ownership forever. What is the point in having Auckland Transport, for example, with no democratic oversight? We're never going to sell the roads.
Well, he said this morning he doesn't have legal powers, but if he gets his council outside, he is going to change things in that area.
See, that is the thing. You've got, and it's a really interesting article by Henry Cook in the Sunday Star Times yesterday, that the re-elected Labor mayors, neither of them campaigned as being Labor, being Leon Dalzell in Christchurch and Phil Goff in Auckland, despite having had the profile of having been cabinet ministers. The Labor-aligned mayor in Wellington, a different set of circumstances, perhaps, but was the one who got upset, tipped out. And is there an expectation that if you have an alignment between the politics of your mayor and the politics of the government, you would like to see some progress on some stuff affecting your city?
Yeah, well, it didn't seem to make any difference in Auckland. I mean, I'd like to just circle back to the politics in Auckland. I do agree with Matthew absolutely that that neither local body election results nor indeed by-elections have any real significance when it comes to general elections. Labor performed really well in those two areas throughout the key era and then utterly dismally in the general elections. And I was always quite interested and even a little bit anxious, despite, you know, polling that should have provided me with reassurance throughout, on the Auckland mayoralty. I thought the Tamariri campaign kind of made sense, that, you know, you had a jumbo jet full of baggage, but an outsider, he could claim business experience with the trust, you know, not a career politician, pick up Maori, maybe Pacifica votes in the south, sweep his home area of the west, and then for enough Conservative voters to pick up the signals from Michelle Bogue and Christine Fletcher that they should vote for him. But, you know, the whole thing's proved to be a catastrophe for them, and John Tamahere performed worse than Victoria Crone or John Polino did in the last two elections. And it'd be really interesting to see whether the when the ward by ward results come out, just where John Tamahere got votes and where he didn't. On Phil Goff's majority, which is close to 100,000 now, he may well have won the West, John Tamahere's home ground, and it certainly doesn't seem as if National voters followed the lead of Michelle Bogue and Christine Fletcher at all. So when there was a bit of a mood for change in other results, I thought that was a really good one for Phil Goff. And I mean, I don't think anybody doubts that, you know, he's firmly branded as a Labour person, but I do think people do feel more comfortable if you do position as an independent.
On the question of Wellington, though, what do you think has happened there? And is this in some ways almost a protest vote over a number of matters that do not seem to have progressed despite a Labour government being in power?
Yeah, I think that could be part of it. I mean, I have to sort of totally confess, I was away, to be fair to myself, and probably no one else will be, that, and I think I'm in line with other Labour people, that, you know, there wasn't anybody sensing an upset, you know, in terms of that mayoral result. In fact, in the voting, I just voted one for Justin Lester, and for the other district, for the Regional Council and Health Board, I wanted to vote for and against people, which meant that I could vote 1 to 5 rationally and 20 to 23 rationally, and then rather with shameful randomness fill out the remainder of it. Whereas if I thought there was a contest, I certainly would have ranked the mayoral candidates as well. But what people have said, you know, I took some soundings on this, is that he was significantly outspent. I mean, not huge amounts of money is spent, but it was sort of 5 to 1. There was no kind of core message from the Leicester campaign that people could discern. There was, and we were discussing this earlier, Catherine, there is a feeling of malaise about Wellington at the moment, that, you know, buildings are closing, Auckland's seizing cultural leadership. You know, there's not so much kind of self-contract.
You can't catch a bus, which is not his territory, but yeah, is feeding into a high level of frustration.
Well. Yeah, yeah. Then he didn't, and he said himself on the night, he didn't distance himself from the regional council's responsibility for what was the biggest issue and biggest complaint in Wellington. You know, and the question is really, well, why didn't you? There was that Genta letter, which, you know, maybe had some influence and sort of a bit messy and no sort of second tunnel, and there was suggestion of sort of green influence on, you know, Wellington council policy. None of these things sort of seemed to me overwhelming. And then, of course, there's the Jackson factor, I mean, Andy Foster, last time, he's been around forever, nobody's ever paid huge amount of attention to him, I don't think. He got fifth last time with 4.7% first preference vote, and now he's the mayor. So you know, that's quite interesting, and there's a lot of sort of social media attacks on Peter Jackson, you know, and it may be that his kind of positioning as a sort of hero across right and left may well have reached a tipping point.
I'm astonished that people did not think it might be close. And when it gets close with STV, frankly, it almost becomes a lottery.
It should have polled.
Often the person who will FPP through, who will win, this happened to Kerry Prendergast against Celia Wade
Brown. But nobody was expecting that, and nobody was expecting.
But it's the point, because the second and third votes can add up to tip someone ahead of people think FPP and they're voting STV.
Yeah, I think STV brings a lot of randomness into local
body
results.
It does if
results.
It's close.
Yeah, and when you don't know who the people are, you know, and you're not making particularly thoughtful choices beyond your first choices.
So there's the big cities. Dunedin also has a new mayor, but that was less of an issue because Dave Cull standing down after an amount of time. If you're thinking central government, all that's a Green aligned mayor, which is, I suppose, an interesting factoid. Again, I'm not sure how much it plays into things. What do you both make of the turnout, though? Like, I've seen some really interesting debates saying that there's no panacea in the online voting. The real issue is, why are people simply not engaged?
I think that's right. I don't think that the method of voting matters all that much, given that the turnout is double at least for general elections, when we can early vote, but we still, many of us, go to the polling booth. It is remarkable when you think about it, because you think of the big problems that people, again, this is an Auckland centric view, but the big problems people talk about all the time are housing, which is strongly influenced by the processes within local government for the speed with which things can be built and the speed with which infrastructure can be put in place in order to support new housing developments. Obviously, transport, obviously infrastructure generally. These are the things which people say they care about most, and they are, at heart, local government issues. And I think the problem is that these local bodies do not actually have enough power. And bear with me on this, but you know, the principle, again, mentioning the European Union, their principle of subsidiarity, that the decision should be made by the as close to the people as possible, is something which I think we would benefit from. The New Zealand Initiative, the old Business Roundtable, has done a whole lot of work based on the Swiss model, where local government has an enormous amount of power. There aren't big councils like the Auckland Super Council. They're very small. They're hundreds of households rather than tens of thousands. And, well, Switzerland is not a basket case, but the idea is that that people can make decisions very close to their communities about what they would like to see happen, including over things like planning laws. And I think the Auckland Super City is a failed experiment, and I hope that Gough does a little bit more than saying he's going to try and influence these things.
I think feeding into that is the demise of local media coverage, which means you know you used to be able to pick up your paper and see people whinging about where a car park was or what was happening to this or that. It's so rare now to have any knowledge of what your council's doing.
If it had power, it would be role for media, ironically.
Here's another point. You know, I was just thinking, Stephen and I were just batting around the Wellington situation. Where is someone going and advocating to central government? We have got this massive earthquake resilience issue. It is affecting individual citizens who bought apartments in good faith and are now faced with big bills. It is affecting the fact we've got the heart of our central city closed down, the library's stuck as a pop-up somewhere for a capital city. Where is even the conversation about a plan for a large long-term loan for one city and, in fact, for multiple cities to begin to deal with resilience issues?
But that's kind of a general issue for all cities,
isn't it?
Their funding is from rates, and that's...
This is to Matthew's point.
Yeah.
And we're about to talk about the surplus, so let's segue into it. You've got a whacking great big surplus here, but the real upfront costs at the moment are on council rates. I know it's a subject of a lot of discussion. This is where the climate change pressures are all coming on, the earthquake strengthening pressures are all coming on.
And they don't have the funding for it.
And yet there's no funding connection for it between central and local
Which
government.
Which is why mayors and councils can't really make huge sort of vision-filled promises about what they're doing. They're just kind of doing what they can within that very difficult to increase rating base. I mean, the kind of rule of thumb used to be that if there was an interesting mayoral contest, turnout would lift, but that doesn't seem to have happened this time, even in Auckland. I mean, perhaps a sign that people weren't expecting a contest in Wellington is that in what is meant to be New Zealand's most political city, the turnout was utterly dismal.
Because turnout was a one-horse race on the West Coast, about 50%.
Yeah.
But come to my point, because let's talk about the surplus now. Whether or not you completely restructure government in New Zealand and the responsibility between central and local government, that's a big picture conversation. But where are you and how are you going to spend a multi-billion dollar surplus in a way that looks like it is going to address some of people's real upfront close problems? The cost of housing in a city, the cost of earthquake resilience, the cost of looming climate change pressures. And is that going to have to be part of the narrative next year for Labor?
Well, I think for everybody, I think there needs to be a change in how we think about the funding of infrastructure and its importance. And essentially, the last time a government really decided to invest in infrastructure in a big way was the Muldoon government with Think Big. Very, very, you know, it was criticised very, very strongly. In retrospect, you have to say, where on earth would New Zealand be without the Clyde Dam and some of the other initiatives that were put in place? In fact,
are you declaring in favour of Think Big, Matthew?
I'm not declaring. I'm just commentating on this. You know, those things were built. In fact, when you think about it in the context of climate change, which I doubt Muldoon would have ever thought about or known about, some of those developments are out New Zealand's biggest single contribution to the fight against climate change by shifting into hydro. But they were financed poorly. There was then a period of very high interest rates where the government's burden, you know, that it had to pay for debt servicing was so high, and it took a long time to get through that. But we're in a different world now, and I think that we've overreacted to that so that governments of all colours are averse to borrowing for infrastructure. But at a time when 10-year government yields on 10-year government bonds are now 1%, There is essentially free money available in offshore. The cost of borrowing, the fiscal cost of borrowing to a government is now zero, effectively zero. And I would have thought that our political parties should therefore have different answers to fiscal policy than what they had 30 years ago.
But
and they
beyond
don't.
That, some of the councils are barely financially viable. I think Auckland had that debt limit, didn't it, where it actually couldn't borrow anymore.
But who's imposed that? Well, I mean, why is there a debt limit?
My point is the central government could be on lending to local government for something like earthquake resilience, a 50-year bond scheme or something along those lines. And it's sort of been muttered about briefly for years. And meantime, the debts continue and the building closures continue, and not just in one city.
Well, that would make the local government more dependent on central government. I would have thought you would give...
They just want a funding stream to get stuff done.
Given that people aren't interested in local government, and given that it is largely a fiasco, but it needs more power. It needs more power
to
borrow. It
needs more funding anyway.
Yeah. Well, no, but the problem with doing that is that means all these mayors are really just little lobbyists for their regions to the all-powerful beehive.
And well, Swiss cantons can raise tax directly, and they have they have different rates.
Problem is they're already taxing their residents in the form of rates, and this is what's freaking them out. Most of them, just to maintain business as usual, are looking at double-figure rates increases. How the hell do you do the other stuff?
And it's an intensely acute political problem for them to manage rates increases. And there's always the attraction of the candidate who comes in and promises to freeze rates, so you've got that constraint as well.
So, okay, let's come back to the $7.5 billion surplus, part of which I think is the revaluing of certain assets, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really a $4 billion.
Okay, it's still big. What do they do with it and when?
Well, I think, you know, the commentary on this is it's just full of vicious ironies for Labor. If there'd been a $7.5 billion deficit announced, you know, due to, say, adverse trading conditions, you know, overseas disturbances and some kind of revaluation which went the other way for New Zealand Rail instead of increasing the supposed deficit this time, well, people would be saying the gates of sort of socialist hell have opened and, you know, God knows what Simon Bridges would be ranting and raving
about
how
really
Labor
care about
can manage
the
money.
The more important issue is
but,
now
I mean, like,
what
but if you have a $7.5 billion, let me just finish this point, $7.5 billion surplus, well then, you know, Labor's still in trouble that it seemed to be said to be on the right to be fleecing taxpayers, taxing them to the eyeballs, and by the left is, you know, cruelly ignoring social problems which could be dealt with. Whereas really $4 billion isn't that much. And if something's baked in, like, say, a tax cut is National sort of demanding yet again, well then the deficit next year forecast only 1.3, so you're in trouble on that front. And you've got kind of, you know, obviously a softening international economy. So I think some caution is required.
I don't think this is a problem.
Having said that, I agree with those who say that I don't think for political reasons the deficit target should be abandoned, but I do think the debt should be. I mean, we're kind of miles away from every Western country. We're only, and it's down under 20 now. I think that should be relaxed, and I think there should be major
infrastructure. So what do they do? Do they want to next budget at the very latest with something that is big and substantial and is not business as usual?
Yeah, and it should be in social housing. It should be in long-term climate change mitigation, which, you know, local government is tackling. But, you know, in some of the interviews you've done with people from Hawke's Bay and so on, you know, they have no practical way of funding what they know is going to happen. And I think also, which is happening already, there's rebuilding of hospitals in Auckland, Waikato, Taranaki, Christchurch and Dunedin. That should, you know, they should get that right where there has been underfunding for a long period.
Matthew.
Well, I think the problem with infrastructure projects is you've got to ask what would be the, you know, what does the government want out of this if it wants to do something more with the surplus? I mean, we know what it is doing. It's going to pay off debt with it. And there are some new policies that were announced in the budget. So the question really is what they might do that they're not intending to do. The problem with infrastructure is that it's not stimulatory immediately, although there are some projects in the roading area that were cancelled or weren't progressed as they were going to be, that perhaps they could relaunch. But if one of the things the government wants to do is to respond to the Reserve Bank, which has largely run out of space for monetary stimulus, and if the government then thinks, well, we need to do a fiscal stimulus, then I don't think that announcing things in next year's budget in the infrastructure space is a very smart move, because that will end up, like so many government interventions end up being, counter-cyclical. The infrastructure projects will begin in 2, 3, 4 years when it's too late. One of the things they could do, which is done a lot in the United States, is if they really want to, if they have got $4 billion of cash and they want to have a fiscal stimulus, they could do a rebate. And the benefit, and they've done this in California.
So like a temporary tax cut.
Well, it's just a one-off. Ronald Reagan did it in 1968, I think, when he was governor of California. The surplus was much higher than expected, so he returned it, a big chunk of it. So what Labor, and what that does is it doesn't change your long-term tax policy. So if Labor wanted to be bold, I have absolutely no expectation this will happen, by the way, because we now have had 20-odd years.
How much would anybody get out of that?
$1,000 each, easily. What you could do is you could return
$20
that,
a week.
That four, but no, it's a one-off check. You would. It's not a $20 a week.
This is what Rudd and Labor did in 2000 post GFC in Australia.
And what it does is it stimulates straight away. Now you could
politically, it went really badly for them.
Why?
It was seen as hurling money, and there were also a lot of which were highlighted that it went to dogs, it went to dead people, it went to people who'd only been in the country for 10 minutes.
You can do it under the guise of wanting an immediate.
I don't care. Rudd did something incompetently is not a reason that we shouldn't do it.
And they also did smaller infrastructure projects as well. They did a credible amount of small scale projects in schools, and some of them went really badly as well. But that got things, you know, they did avoid recession. Yeah. But that was when there was, you know, obviously a massive crisis, you know, threatening existential results at the time. It may be necessary.
They could do it under the umbrella of the Reserve Bank's plea.
Let's say it was $1,000 per person age 18 and above. You could, if you wanted, make it more socially just and orientate it more towards poorer people if you wanted, if you're a Labor government. But the important thing is, you say, look, we've got declining business confidence, we've got declining consumer confidence, we've got this...
Go out and spend.
$4 billion into the economy.
Are we in a crisis? I think indexation is something that should be... I mean, if that costs $600 million, which was the National Party figure when they Simon Bridges announced that policy, I think that's manageable, well and truly manageable within that deficit. And it's always hard to argue against that. If you set tax rates as appropriate this year, you know, why aren't they appropriate next year or 2 years down the track? So that's something that could be done that would be
It is risky, but I see the logic of it. For a start, it's sizable. You avoid that chewing gum budget trap that Labor moved into when we'd accurately reported actually that they were going to move the thresholds, and somehow it became some massive tax cut through unmanaged expectations.
The deep dark secret.
So for a start, it has impact. You do have the Reserve Bank's who've essentially asked for it. So you could pitch it that way. I still think...
They could quote that Ronald Reagan did it if they're going to be accused of crazy lefties. I mean, it does make sense.
Really well.
National would have to cancel
It would be paid out, and then you'd have an election.
Here's the other thing. I do sense, and I'm curious and would love you guys to go and test whether there is a move and an urge, and perhaps it's off the back of all the climate action and strikes, and 140,000 people turned out for that climate strike. There is a sense of people wanting to see a longer term plan, and yes, that's up against the hip pocket short termism of every election, but if you brought the two out together, Stephen, you know?
What, $1,000 and don't take it if we're going to...
Here's our long term...
And here's another $1,000 if you buy an electric
mitigation
car or
fund. I don't know.
We've already got that.
But I'll tell you what would be quite good for this government, or indeed the next government, is to break away from this model of politics that we have in New Zealand that goes something like, we're the government, we would like to do this thing, but we can't do this thing because the opposition would say this terrible thing about it, so therefore we're not going to do it.
Problem is, election results are determined on that basis.
Well, Stephen, it's a hell of a lot easier to have an ad. It's a hell of a lot easier to have an ad out there criticising you for giving people $1,000 than calling something a car tax or a death tax like they did in Australia with the tax changes.
Well, there was no death tax.
I know there wasn't, but the social media ad says there was.
Yeah.
But good luck screwing around $1,000 gift into something that works as an attack like that. Let's talk about National, and I suppose he's back, isn't he? Christopher Luxon seems to have announced several times that he would like to become a National MP. Are we getting closer? And what do you make again of the way the desire to run for Botany has been announced, Matthew?
Well, I understand the selection will happen in early November. I also understand that the Botany National Party, I was told, has roughly 580 members, and that means 58 of the 60 delegates will be genuinely local people, and there'll only be two top-up delegates from the regional office, so it will be a highly democratic vote. National's always proud of the fact that they have these local selections, which of course mean things like Clem Simich gets selected over David Kirk, the World Cup rugby captain, winning captain. I assume he'll get it. It would be incredibly reckless for him to have made that announcement, which has raised eyebrows in a negative way, through Jessica Mutch, the TVNZ political editor, if he hadn't gone around those 58 people and had cups of tea with them. But if he hasn't, he will lose. If he has not done the groundwork to meet those people and make them like him, they will be thoroughly unimpressed to have first heard about this through a political editor of a TV network. People planning to seek nomination for the National Party aren't even meant to know political editors, let alone make announcements through them. So I've just got to assume that he has done the work behind the scenes, or he wouldn't have made that announcement.
It'd be sort of highly insulting almost to New Zealand business community if he wasn't picked. I read Duncan Gardner saying it's there for him if he wants to be national leader and prime minister. It's just, you know, a matter of him picking it up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. I think it's likely to end in tears. There's a couple of reasons. I think it's never good to come into a caucus with future leaders stamped on your forehead, and that, you know, just causes you issues. And the scenarios are if Simon Bridges isn't prime minister after the next election, he'll go. So yes. Will they then turn to somebody who's only been in Parliament for 5 minutes as their leader? I don't think so. So
Key had a year as finance spokesman.
And he'd been around for 6 years. Yeah. And I mean, I think also this whole thing that this is John Key revisited. John Key wasn't a business person. He was a trader, and that was the secret of his skills. He could make decisions on what was in front of him, quick and right decisions, and that's what he did, and that's why he was non-ideological. That's why he never used his popularity to go right. And he would have been very good at losing big clients, and he made voters like him as well. Business people come in, they've had people being defer to them, they ask for something, it gets done, they get respect. It's a totally different world he's entering, and he'll be aware of that logically, but the reality is still going to hit.
Thanks, guys. There's other stuff that we'll have to leave till next time. Busy old week. Thank you very, very much, Stephen Mills and Matthew Hooton.